Good morning, family. A joyful Feast of Tabernacles to you all. And I want to get right to it. So please, if you would, open up your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 58. Isaiah 58. We will read just one verse here, verse 12. Reading from the New King James, Isaiah 58, verse 12. Those from among you shall build the old waste places. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations, and you shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in. Now, this verse is included in the United Church of God feast pamphlet section titled Role of the Resurrected Saints in the Millennium. Now, I want you to, if you would, really picture this time in your mind of something run down, ruins being built up, of a group of lost people who are sick, they're weary, being found, strengthened, and healed. We have a wonderful future. And our booklet goes on to say, quote, God has allocated 1,000 years during which people whom God resurrects at Christ's return will experience an unparalleled opportunity to work with him, to help all people build a relationship with him. Now, we rightfully talk a lot, particularly here at the Feast of Tabernacles, about where we're headed, what's up ahead, our future alongside Jesus Christ. It's an exciting opportunity, to be sure. And today, if you would, please turn to John chapter 4. John chapter 4, because our King is going to add to our opportunity. And we'll see what I mean by adding to our opportunity. But I first want to take a moment to really set the scene, what we're going to be stepping into here in John 4. Now, all of us here are disciples, right? Which is great. Because I ask that you really put yourself in the shoes of a disciple, following your teacher, Jesus Christ. You've been with him a while by this point, and on this particular day, he says, we're headed north. We're going to Galilee to do some work and some ministry there. Now, to get from where we are in Judea in the south all the way up north in Galilee, we either pass through Samaria or we would go around it. And you, as a disciple, would expect to go around. That was the custom because we don't have any dealings or associations with the Samaritans at all. But with Jesus leading the way and we're following, he begins taking us through Samaria. Okay. Perhaps we can't spare the extra 3 days of travel time it takes to go around. He must be in a rush to get up to Galilee. And as we're walking, Jesus sends us into the town of Sychar to buy some food. It's the middle of the day. It was commonplace to have a light midday lunch, bread, perhaps some olives, some fruit. But it's a little bit of an uncomfortable errand for us because, again, we're not used to interacting with Samaritans at all. But we go into the town of Sychar, we get our food, and we get out. And as we return to our teacher with the food, so we can all eat, and before pressing on to our destination up in Galilee, we urge him to eat. And all this is well and good. It's a pretty normal day for us so far in a life of a disciple. And that's where we're going to step into John 4, verse 27. Now, it's at this point, his disciples, that would be us, we come and we marvel that Jesus talked with a woman, yet no one said, what do you seek, or why are you talking with her? Now, the woman here is that famous Samaritan woman at the well, whom Jesus had spoken to about living water, about all the things of her life, and we're stunned. But we don't ask anything further. We allow our minds, our focus, to drift back to the important things, like lunch. After all, our master sent us into town to get food. And this, as the Samaritan woman departs, we do urge Jesus, eat, eat, teacher. But it's at this point that he really begins to interrupt our day. Verse 34, John 4, verse 34. My food, he says, is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. And we're like, wait, are we not even going to eat then or what? I guess we don't, we're in that much of a hurry. We don't have any time to waste to get up north. Full steam ahead, all eyes on Galilee and our mission there. But not so fast, because Jesus says this, verse 35, he says, "Do you not say there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields. They're already white for harvest." Now, from our point of view, we're in Samaria. We're here. We're just passing through. There's nothing for us or for our work here. But our master stops us and says, "No, look up. Look at the fields." Now, to where or what exactly was Jesus directing our eyes and attention? Please, if you would, move up to verse 30. John 4, verse 30, it says, "Then they..." Now they, in verse 30, are the Samaritans in Sychar, whom the Samaritan woman at the well had gone and told all about Jesus and what he had done in their conversation. She was excited, and here they are. That's the they here. Resuming verse 30, "These Samaritans went out of Sychar, and they're coming to Jesus." In other words, our master directs our eyes toward this group of people. It's a people we would consider lost, a spiritual ruin. But Jesus says, "Look," and that word means more, of course, than just physically see. It means to look with a wondering concern. It means to look with consideration, careful and deliberate vision. So in your mind now, without any other distraction, please imagine looking on this group of people approaching with a wondering concern. And as you visualize them approaching, let's allow Jesus to interrupt any assumptions we may hold. And let's hear him say, "I want you to see a harvest. They're ready now." This would have been quite a disruption. Samaritans, we avoid them. And by the way, we have good, justifiable biblical reasons. Why, I think. Master, really? Them? They're a lost cause. Now, theirs was a religion that was mixed at best, and at worst, pagan. Now, fast forward to us today, disciples in 2025. We too are walking with Jesus Christ. We too are here to understand and anticipate our future ahead. But we're not merely here passing through. We can allow our master to interrupt us and to prompt us to look. Verse 39, John 4, verse 39, "And many Samaritans of that city believed in him because of the word of the woman who testified." Middle of verse 40, "The Samaritans urged Jesus to stay with them, and he did stay there 2 days. And many more believed because of his own word." So beyond any of the disciples' expectation, this spiritual ruin began to be built up. These lost people began to be repaired and strengthened. It was an experience that would have pierced. It was an experience these disciples could now take with them. They could remember and take with them going forward. And hopefully we can too. And the title of our message today is directly from the words of our master: "Lift up your eyes and look." Lift up your eyes and look. I found it best to break our message up into 4 parts today. So part 1, rooted and grounded in love. Rooted and grounded in love. Part 1 is about us. It's about us being prepared for this work. Because if we don't examine our own internal condition first, then despite any good aspiration or intention, our natural inclination will not be to look upon others the way Jesus himself did and the way that he wants us to. In 2016, the band The Avett Brothers released a song titled "No Hard Feelings." It was written by Seth Avett, the younger of 2 brothers. He said it took him 7 years to complete that song. and the music in it, the song, the lyrics, all of it, I find to be quite striking and impactful. And I'm going to read just a small part of it now. The song says, "When my body won't hold me anymore, and it finally lets me free, will I be ready? When my feet won't walk another mile, and my lips give their last kiss goodbye, will my hands be steady? When I lay down my fears, my hopes, and my doubts, the rings on my fingers and the keys to my house, with no hard feelings. When the sun hangs low in the west and the light in my chest won't be kept held at bay any longer. And when the jealousy fades away and it's ash and dust for cash and lust and it's just hallelujah. And no hard feelings because our Lord knows they haven't done much good for anyone. They've kept me afraid and cold with so much to have and hold." Now, to me, the song's impact stems from its ability to interrupt routine thoughts where our minds are every day. It interrupts those and draws our mind to the end of our physical life, which is a powerful place because what we deem to be important is quickly reprioritized. Our sense of immediacy and urgency increases, and it's at that time, at the end of our physical lives, that we can more fully and readily appreciate how truly unnecessary any hard feelings really are. We know we won't be bringing these with us into the millennium, into the kingdom. And so the song rightfully challenges us then to consider the utility or lack thereof of holding on to these feelings now. For what? In Hebrews chapter 12, we are cautioned not to allow any root of bitterness to spring up. Any unresolved anger, resentment, or hurt that can cause us trouble or can leave us afraid and cold, as the song says, towards others. Instead, our hearts must be rooted elsewhere. Please turn to Ephesians chapter 3. Ephesians chapter 3. Paul is in prayer. And in his prayer, he prays this, verse 16. Ephesians 3, verse 16, Paul prays that God would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with might in the inner man, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, and that you, being rooted and grounded in love. As members of God's family, we have so much to share with others. We have a truth that's freeing. We have a hope that the world doesn't have. And each of us has personal testimony of what God and Jesus Christ has done for you. How tragic it is, isn't it, for people to be walking trapped in deception and without any true hope. We can be rooted in, grounded in, and filled with the love of Jesus Christ so that we don't walk blindly in regards to compassion. It's a lesson we can see easily in the book of Jonah. God said, "Go to Nineveh. These are lost people. Go teach them. They don't know their right hand from their left." And Jonah said, "I don't want to. I don't love them." There's a story I came across that I'd like to share about a man named Ike Brown. Ike Brown, he's been a police officer in Florida since 1986. His son, Ike Jr., was born in 1980, his firstborn. Now, Ike Sr. and his son have a good bond, a good relationship. In an interview that I watched a few years ago, Ike Sr. talked about always going to his son's sports games and how much fun they had together. And listening to him speak, you could just hear how proud he was of his son and how much love and closeness there was between them. Well, fast forward to 2002. Ike Jr., his son, was 21 years old. Ike Sr. still working as a police officer. And he says, "On May 27th, 2002, around 4:45 in the morning, I was getting ready for work. I hear my doorbell ring. I open. It's my sergeant, my lieutenant, the chief, and the chaplain. I said, wait, chaplain, why are you here? Someone says to me, Ike Jr., your son, has been murdered. He thought, it can't be. Why? Why is this happening? I mean, he's, you know, he began to struggle, obviously, to process this. And then came anger and said, I love my kids. And I'd always said, if anyone hurts my kids, I'm going to hurt them. Now, if there were ever a situation where a root of bitterness could set in, take hold, this would be it, right? Dealing with the murder of your own child, anger, grief, depression. Later, he said, when the trial began, I drove up to court not knowing what was going to happen. I mean, if you put yourself there, you're driving to court, and I guess you're praying, please help me through this. You do your best just to make it through. Well, Ike said, I got to court. I walked in. And the minute that I looked up and laid eyes on him, I'm telling you, I loved him. Him was his son's murderer. How could this be? How could Ike love that man? Ike said, what was happening inside of me, I knew it was from God. I knew it was God. It was hard, he said, for me to understand. But I didn't want to hurt him. I wanted to hug him. Instead of being naturally overtaken in rage or bitterness, Ike allowed Jesus Christ and his love to reign. We know Christ was reigning because this is completely unnatural that Ike was moved to lift up his eyes and look with love. And Ike said, I began at that moment to labor spiritually for this man, really praying earnestly for him. Amazing. We can also allow Christ to reign in us, to be rooted in his love. And if we truly are, we're going to be drawn to part two. We'll be drawn to the field. Part two, seek and save the lost. Seek and save the lost. Please turn to John chapter 5. Now, what Jesus Christ said in John 4, do you not say 4 months and then the harvest? It jumps out to me, spiritually speaking, when you think about God's harvests, that you have the Feast of the First Fruits, Pentecost, in the third month on God's calendar. And then you have the fourth month, fifth, sixth, and then 4 months later, it's the seventh month. And here we are at the Feast of Tabernacles, the second harvest. And thinking about it that way is a direct challenge, and it confronts any presumptions we might hold of others and the timing of when they might be called. So we're here in John 5. Now, verse 1 says it's the feast. It's not specific as to which one, perhaps because this was Jesus' approach at all feasts. And what approach might that be? Let's join our teacher in verse 3. John 5, verse 3, in these five porches lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed. We'll stop there. Have you ever seen a makeshift homeless community? You know, in Houston, underneath Interstate 10, there was an encampment. I want you to visualize, this is the type of place that we are. The Pool of Bethesda, or Bethsaida. A group of sick and lost people who superstitiously believe that this pool can heal them. Now, it's the feast. It's a time when people set their eyes on Jerusalem. They are headed towards the temple to worship. But Jesus stops outside the temple and looks up. Verse 5. Now, a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he'd been in that condition a long time, our teacher said to him, do you want to be made well? Now Jesus stopped and he saw this man. Again, that Greek word is more than just being able to physically see him. It means looking upon him with consideration, thought about him. Now verse 7, the sick man answered our teacher. He said, sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I'm coming, another steps down before me. Now let's see. Who is this man? We have a man here who doesn't seem to know Jesus Christ at all. He believes in superstition. He's chronically ill. He's imprisoned in his condition. And he's been this way for 38 years. Now, all of these are things that might lead one to believe and presume God is just not calling him right now. He is still, metaphorically speaking, 4 months and in the next harvest. But Jesus sees it differently. And ultimately, the man in ruins that we see there in that community seeking a superstitious healing, we can then find a few verses later, in verse 15, he's witnessing in the temple of God that Jesus Christ made him well. It's another masterclass from our teacher. We won't turn there, but in Luke 19, he said, I came to seek and save the lost. There's another marginalized man I want to tell you a little bit about. And his name is Tekoya. Tekoya Criner was someone who had a rough childhood, and he grew up without any real father. Now, you can argue people have a choice to work hard through adversity or succumb to it. Well, one way or another, Tekoya allowed himself to get into trouble. He got involved dealing and using drugs. And without getting into all the details, he did some awful things. And ultimately, he wound up in jail. He was sentenced to many years. And as he sat in that prison, Tekoya says, I was desperate. I sat in my cell feeling so lost and alone. And as I was listening and you're hearing him describe his condition, it was like I was right back at the Pool of Bethesda, hearing this man, all the way down to the fact it would be many years for him there. Now, you and I both know there's so many people out there who are in physical, mental, spiritual prisons. As you consider Tekoya or someone in his position, I find it challenging not to presume, even with some certainty, that they're part of the next harvest. But we can replace that thinking with our master's approach. And by this point, I think all of us here can say, yeah, there's hope for him, even right now, for Tekoya. But if there's hope, who could or would lift up their eyes and look? Part 3, the joy of the labor. The joy of the labor. Back to Ike Brown for a minute, the man who'd lost his 21-year-old son, his firstborn, who himself was surprised to look upon his son's killer, not with anger and hatred, but with love and compassion. Well, after the trial was over, the accused defendant became a convicted murderer. Ike Sr. said, I was always mindful of him, praying for him. I'd even started writing him a letter a few times, but I would just quickly throw him away. But then finally, he said, after about 3 years, I wrote him again, and this time I quickly mailed it before I could back out. And in that letter, I told him, I've been praying for you, and I know being in prison is tough enough, meaning, hey, I'm not writing this letter to make your situation any tougher than it already is. And well, near the end of the letter, he says, I wrote, I need a favor because I miss my son, Ike Jr. Can you please help to fill in for him? I was nervous, said Ike. I didn't know how this man in prison was going to respond. But about a month later, I received this response. It said, Dear Mr. Brown, I now know that God is real. Now, the man that wrote those words to Ike, I now know that God is real, was Tekoya Criner. In other words, it was Tekoya who had shot and killed Ike Jr. many years ago, and who was now in jail, lost and alone. Now, Ike could have prayed for Tekoya and left it at that, but he allowed Jesus to lead him further. He approached Tekoya. He visited him in prison through that letter. And then consider this next statement from Tekoya, who is there in his cell. And he said, you see, I had told God that if he, God, meant what he said in his word, if he really did forgive me, if he really did love me, then I really wanted to hear from you, Ike. And that if I did hear from you, then I'd give my life to God. Tokoya then told the interviewer this, and when I got Ike's letter, I didn't even get through the first sentence without knowing exactly what this was. It was God speaking through this beautiful man. It broke me down right there, and I now knew that God's love, his mercy, his salvation was real. And I now no longer walk with the burden of a life sentence. I walk knowing that I'm free. Now, just like when Jesus stopped at Sychar and spent 2 days with the Samaritans, just like when he went into that community at the Pool of Bethesda, it was again absolutely God who went into that prison. He just did so through Ike Sr. And this is the opportunity that we have even now. Ike and Tokoya have an ongoing relationship, and they both describe the joy that it has brought them. Yes, there can be such joy in this labor. Now on to part four, our final part. Part four, lift up your eyes and look. Lift up your eyes and look. Marginalized people can hear from and encounter God when they come into contact with you. A recent example I'd like to share. My friend, I'll call him Christian, he encountered a homeless man. I think we've all been there. And with deliberate vision, he looked upon that man with concern, consideration. Now, the man predictably asked Christian for some money. And my friend said, look, sir, I'm not going to give you any money. But may I buy 5 minutes of your time? The man looked at Christian, must have been dumbfounded, because why would anyone else think that his time, a homeless person, was valuable? So the man, kind of stunned, Christian repeated, I have a $20 bill. May I buy the next 5 minutes of your time? The man, of course, said yes. And my friend prayed with him and prayed for him during those 5 minutes. And their encounter ended with the homeless man, who clearly hadn't had a chance to bathe in weeks, clinging on to my friend, embracing him as he expressed just how much he needed that. It was God who went to that homeless man. He just did so through Christian. Please turn to Matthew chapter 9, our final scripture. Matthew 9, starting in verse 36. Matthew 9:36. But when Jesus saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary and scattered like sheep with no shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Again, our brother, our master is looking, he's seeing, he's considering these people, and he calls them a harvest again. And he says they're plentiful at that. Verse 38, he says to us, therefore pray that the Lord of the harvest send out laborers into his harvest. You hear him saying that, you can hear his desire for the lost, for the weary. You can feel it. And he instructs us to pray not for a quicker arrival of the millennium, but rather to pray for more laborers now. Now, Christ says he lives in us through his Spirit. We are ambassadors for Christ. In other words, this is Jesus Christ's life continued, his ministry to the lost. It's continued through us as he lives in us. And we labor according to that love. And what we've heard is today is about an opportunity. What we've heard is an invitation to what? You know, when I consider these various smaller, even individual restorations that we've gone over today, these building up that we've discussed, you can imagine them as part of the tapestry of God's work over the millennia to date, up to this time. It's a beautiful tapestry. It's a beautiful image to meditate on. And yes, it's not the full fulfillment of those 1,000 years to come. Of course not. But there's already more repairing and healing than we may realize. And we have, each of us, has an opportunity to allow God to move in us. We have an invitation to be included in that tapestry. And we'll conclude with a part of that tapestry. Ike Brown and Toya Kreiner, back to them one last time. 7 years after Toya had shot and killed his son, Ike Brown Sr. legally adopted Toya as his own son. When Ike asked him to become his son, Toya, who, remember, grew up essentially fatherless, he said, "In no way am I qualified, but if you will have me, then yes, you are my dad, and I am your son." And this is at the heart of that tapestry, is it not? In many ways, this story, it mirrors the love that God the Father has shown to each of us. So as we go through the rest of the feast and we rightfully hear about that wonderful time ahead in the millennium, about that particular strengthening and healing and building up and restoration, as we properly picture that and anticipate it, let us also take with us for the rest of the feast and when we return home, let's take with us that time and experience today that we spent alongside Jesus Christ. Let's take that experience with us as something tangible that we carry. Let it motivate us to seek the lost. And may we listen to our Master as he interrupts our days and our routines and says to you, "Lift up your eyes and look."